After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi everyone, mind rolling back. I am Raghu. I am with Goshen, my old friend Paley Ellison, and so great to see you again. It's been quite some time.
Yes, it's wonderful to see you too.
So what have you been up to in the interim, Goshen? Okay, so you know, for those of you who don't know, Goshen is from the Zen tradition and has a wonderful center in New York that does extraordinary. Why don't you just describe that a bit? Because even though people might remember, I mean, you guys are really doing something that's worth people knowing about.
Yeah, so my husband and I, we co-founded the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care, which is an educational nonprofit that is dedicated to transforming how we care for each other. And we do that through Zen practice, through direct care, and we've cared for over 100,000 people in the last 13 years. And we have education programs from foundations and contemplative care to bereavement support. And we do a lot of education of doctors and teaching in different integrative medicine fellowships. And we mostly love to think about what's useful and how can we serve. And so that becomes less about our personalities and more about what's useful to people. And it's delightful. And actually this past year, we've been engaged with a nursing home in providing 80 hours of care on two floors and also providing resilience training that is based on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And so we're educating everyone from the doctors to the janitors all together. And so they're learning together in a learning community for a whole year. It's been amazing.
Amazing. That's incredible. Yeah. So for those of you out there, and me might have been amongst them, not currently, but some time ago, thinking, those Zen people, they're in their little dojos hammering away at their minds, okay, and leaving us to fend for ourselves, the little guys. See, this is not true. This is a story. And Goshen and his husband are absolutely exemplary of this. Wait, we're talking about, Goshen's got a wonderful new book called Wholehearted. Here it is, Wholehearted. And Slow Down, Help Up, Help Out, and Wake Up. And so there's a lot of great prescriptions in here and great stories, so it's fun to read. I got to tell you, though, right away, you know what made me so happy? This is really crazy, okay? I read in the book, and it's the chapter around anger, right? And you go, yeah, just look at Ray Donovan. I'm thinking, holy shit, Goshen watches Ray Donovan? I'm embarrassed to tell anybody that I've watched. I have, actually. It is so effing violent. It's unbelievable, right? And what's the story you told in there? Oh, right. Tell the story about his wife and his reaction. That's so great.
Yeah, so he finds out that his wife has died of cancer, and he goes into the family bar and beats up everybody. He just
his entire family.
And he's arrested, and it's like that. But it's so amazing to me, that scene, because it's so like how all of us do if we don't really look at what's arising, and we become what's arising. And I felt such tenderness towards him. It's just like he just couldn't be with it at all, and just was unleashing, as opposed to the quality of anger that we can be with, which is can be so skillful and can be what brings us to activism or social change, is saying no, but to learn how to work with it is an extraordinary possibility. Mm-hmm.
So would you say that then watching Ray Donovan in particular might be a really great spiritual practice then, right?
Totally. I mean, to me, what isn't, you know?
And yeah, right. What isn't is right. What isn't? And the other story that I tell about Ray Donovan, in terms of like when we talk about, and you, it's actually, I did a podcast around a talk Ram Dass gave, and he was speaking of, you really have to work on the psychological shit, because your motivations for practice are usually skewed around ego. You want to get better at something, you want to be happier, you want to get shit, you want to be more powerful, especially the mindfulness thing, which is a whole other axe to grind, really. And dealing with, and we talk about this, and I talk about this with different people, dealing with that stuff that we kind of put aside, you know, or we go, yeah, we don't have to deal with that. You know, the habitual patterns is one way to deal with them, and meditation certainly is a positive way. But I think getting with the right people is also a positive thing. In other words, some therapy and so on. So all leading to this Ray Donovan, I think the last episode, I don't know if you watched it or not, but after he's like, at one point he tries to commit suicide, he's so screwed up, and they get him a psychiatrist played by Alan Alda, actually, he played it really well, and he refuses his help until at the end of the last episode, after he's killed about 13 people, for whatever reason, there's always a good reason, you see him picking up his cell phone, and he makes a call, and on the screen comes the image of Alan as the therapist, and he says, are you ready? Yeah, I think at this time you might be ready, right? Right. Oh, God.
It takes what it takes, you know, yeah,
really,
for us to really arrive where we need to go.
Hopefully not everybody, it's not advised to go out and express yourself in that manner, okay? You know what's really great? How the heck did you get His Holiness to write that fantastic thing for you? Okay, I'm just looking at it going, oh, I mean, this isn't a, hey, somebody write something up, His Holiness will sign it. This looks like he actually, you know, he knows who you are and what you're talking about here.
Well, he's been very supportive of our work from the beginning. Yeah. It's very lovely.
So he said, His Holiness said, he's written a manual for personal growth and change based on contemporary interpretation of Buddhist refuge and precepts, making it accessible to everyone, not just those interested in practicing Buddhism. And using anecdotes, quotes, and reflective questioning, he prompts us to become aware of the barriers we have erected around ourselves and suggest ways by which we can dismantle them, right? And that, ain't that what it's all about? But that's a pretty high praise, and it sets you into the book knowing, okay, His Holiness has put the stamp of approval on this. This is so great, Koshin. There's something maybe you can talk about that I think is really important, and it's at the beginning of the book, and it's around the lone wolf phenomenon. And I think you had a little story of meeting somebody, right? Taking a bus in Colorado or something. Tell that story. It's a great story.
Yeah, I was in my late teens and I was on a Greyhound bus. And I remember there was this person across from me who had a smiling face bag. And I was sitting next to this woman, this wonderful lady, and we were talking. And she said, "Oh, are you a Buddhist?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm Buddhist." And she said, "Oh, so who do you practice with?" And I gave a list. I think at the time it was Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and all the great Jewish Buddhist teachers. And she said, "Well, do you practice with one community in particular?" And I said, "Oh, no, you know, I'm a lone wolf." And she said, "Oh, well, do you know what the thing is about lone wolves?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, a lone wolf is a sick wolf. And you don't want to go near them because wolves are pack animals." And I remember sitting there, sitting back in my seat and thinking, "Holy shit. Whoa." And I just had really saw how I had used kind of spiritual practice as a way to kind of identify it and use it to kind of bypass my fear of belonging and fear of vulnerability, of like people really getting to know me. And it was such a huge wake-up call for me. And I felt so grateful to her too for taking a risk and really meeting me. Yeah,
she had real generosity, which you talk about later as well. But the reality of what's going on, and you talk about this, about with our culture and how it's a weird situation with social media and the way that we isolate ourselves at kind of at the same time. You know, it's a really, really tough tight wire to walk upon, because there's so much good and yet there's so much negativity as well to the way that we're living. Yeah, how are you talking to people, especially next generation people, about really the pitfalls, the promises and pitfalls?
Well, I think it's so interesting. I think it was 2 years ago, there was a study for incoming college freshmen. And the study was, what is their greatest fear about entering college? And the overwhelming response was talking to other people. And so the pitfall of any tool is that it takes away from what we actually can do, which is, for example, talk to another person. So I know many young people who think of, well, why would you call someone when you can text them or on Snapchat or different things? And I feel that anything, including meditation, can become a way of avoiding the reality of intimacy. And for me, the key has always been to keep looking at where I'm turning things into poison that could also be turned back into medicine. So like social media can be an amazing place of connection and organizing and inspiration. And it can also be a place where, you know, there are studies about the amount of social media, how much time you're spending on it can lead to depression, anxiety, and even suicidality. And so depending on, you know, it's always about checking like, well, how much am I living in accord with my own values and what is actually nourishing to me? And for me, I try to think about that every morning as I start the day, and we end the evenings every night saying, you know, we have a traditional Zen chant that at the end says, don't squander your life, that we have just this little time. And so to me, the beginning and ending each day with some kind of awareness of this is it. And how can I show up? How can I nourish myself so that I can nourish others? Yeah.
How can I show up? Yeah. You know, we've talked about this already a couple of times with the spiritual bypass stuff. And I told you I did this thing with Ram Dass, and it was all around motivation and how it's all geared around the ego. I think it's a really important topic, especially for you Buddhist guys, okay, and gals. Because you tend to get, you have this crystalline thing of what's real, which I ascribe to, by the way, but this is something I should get into with Roshi Halifax. She would really ream me for bringing this up. You know her, I'm sure.
Of course.
About getting attached to the doing of meditative practice. In this case, we're talking about to get into the really. I mean, we're not looking for power. We're not looking for control. We're not even maybe necessarily looking to get less unhappy, right? We may be doing it for some of the more right reasons, whatever that might be, but there are super subtle attachments of mind related to states that are become available through these practices. And that's definitely that's why in our and you know that through, of course, knowing Ram Dass and all, our thing is that mixture of heart, and we were taken to the teachings, the Buddhist teachings of Vipassana. We were taken to the Tibetan teachings, and many of us have studied with different Tibetan lamas and had some really wonderful opportunities. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but that has its own little catch-all too.
Absolutely.
Like, people going through the heart and not using, any kind of wisdom practice, that becomes its own spiritual bypass, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for me, it has been the great realization of that we're never done. And, I've always loved that story of Ram Dass after he had his stroke, and when he was, laying there on the gurney and saying, uh-oh. And the humility of that is to me such a joy, and to really understand that we're never done and there's no arrival has been central. And for me, each week when I meet with my teacher, and she, she's 91 and a successor of Peter Matheson and an amazing woman, and still calling me out on subtle and not subtle things. It's been so wonderful to me, it's like the ability to keep ourselves open to where we're getting caught and where I'm getting, a little off center. And to me, the joy is really noticing that moment by moment, we fall away and we can come back, fall away and come back. And that freshness is always available.
Let's talk about zombies, okay? So we do have a lot of zombies at the movies, streaming everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Through our devices. And we, as you say, we love a good apocalypse flick. But then don't go anywhere, because they're right here. The zombies are with us. They are us. Ouch. Yeah. Hungry for connection, lost in our narratives. And thinking about the past, we've constructed about the past and the future. Look to our phones and computers for a morsel of false comfort, or we convince ourselves that someone else's life will bring us contentment or authenticity. I see the zombies everywhere, even in my own mirror. How do we wake up from zombie land? Good question.
Yeah, it's amazing because, the zombies come from the West African and Caribbean cultures, and they originally, the meaning of them were fatherless children. And so it was like orphan children. And so the desire of an orphan child to get life and support from others. And then, of course, it got turned into this kind of bizarre eating other people's brains thing. And it really is like when we don't have that spark of life in ourselves and don't, you know, nourish the conditions that allow that spark to ignite, we do look to other places. And it's amazing, just on my way here to the center today, you know, just seeing people walking down the street like, you know, they are uncontrollable. And they're just like in another world. And there's just something about, you know, my friend Marie talks about, we think that there's going to be these big AI machines and they're going to be marching around the end of the world. But it's that at some point the robots are going to take over. But you look around the streets and in people's homes, or the other night I was at a restaurant and you could see a sea of lights in this beautiful restaurant. And I walked around the restaurant just to see what people are up to. And everyone was on Facebook or Instagram. And this beautiful food is like this very nice restaurant with like farm to table organic food. And people are like this with the phone and just shoveling food in their mouth. And no one's speaking to each other, but everyone is like posting about what they're doing and their food and liking other things. And nobody was actually there. It was so amazing to witness.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Of course, and we've all seen that over and over, and more so and more so in every part of our life, and certainly being out in public. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking, okay, Koshin, not just people, shall we say, who are not potentially as aware as we might be, having done some work over these years. I'm talking about teachers that I know, okay, on their phones, and all for righteous reasons of responding to need as well. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's a tricky, tricky thing.
It's very tricky, and it's not about, to me, shame or blame, but just to like notice, like, do I need to be doing this right now? Ah, taking a breath.
Yeah.
Before picking it up. I'm just there's this become this automatic, you know, just picking up the screen, pick up the screen, pick up the screen, like as if like everything is an emergency, like I've got to get back to them right now. Or you know, how do we allow for a little more breath?
Yeah I have a really good friend from Google, and we were together recently, and I was doing just what you said. I was picking up the thing, and maybe I got to respond to this now. I don't know. She turned to me and went, "Can you please put that robot down?" She's from Google. Okay. So I take that with, yes, I will. You know. Mm-hmm. Also, I love this thing. I mean, and, I may or may not have said, I've been doing a lot of investigation around us all being able to get real in the most practical ways possible and dissect what are the things that prevent. And as His Holiness said about the book, they are, you know, you're unlocking some of these things, which is really great. And so one of the biggest deals, of course, is this. Krishnas calls it the movie of me. And so we've been working on, me and a friend of mine, Duncan Truss, we've been working on this movie of me stuff and doing a lot of talk, and we're going to transcribe, maybe make a book out of it. But, you know, the story that we tell ourselves and believe in. And so I love this story of yours going into the gym. There's some great stories in this book, by the way. I mean, that's what I like. I like a good story. You can't just come at me pedantically and say anything, okay? And Koshin does that. Talk about the guy in the gym. You remember the story? The guy in the gym that every time you never spoken to, and you taught him to be a little pretend, you know.
do what we do. I had a whole story. Yeah. And so I've become a gym person, which is a big surprise to me. And in the gym, there was this guy who I always saw, and there's a whole crew of us who show up at the 7 a.m. time and are usually there for about an hour and a half. And been seeing this guy for about 2 years. And I just realized that I had a story about him. And I was sure that he was kind of pretentious, and because he never said hello. And one day, he usually had his locker across from where I usually am, but this time, for some reason, his locker was right next to mine, and his arm was in a sling. And I said, "Oh, what happened?" And he just turned to me, and he had tears in his eyes, and said, "You know, my mother went into the hospital and just died, and then I got a compression fracture the same day in my collarbone." And he was just crying and crying. And I said, "Tell me about it." And we just sat on the bench, and he told me about his mom. And he told me about his fracture and how painful it was and how painful the sudden death of his mother was. And suddenly I realized, like, what an asshole I had been. And it was so humbling, just sitting there, and I was thinking to myself, I had put like a cone on top of this person and not even had a clue about who this person is. And he was actually incredibly sweet, incredibly sad, and just like a person. And it was just an amazing moment for me to realize, like, how we can be such a jerk in a way, even in a way that we're not even aware of. So like in Zen, we'd have a lot of focus on thoughts, words, and actions, and to like really look at how, like, I had these thoughts that had become kind of solidified around this person. And I realized, like, I wonder how much we do that all the time. Like people in our neighborhood, people who, you know, we see often at the grocery store, the bank, or all these ordinary places, and we make up stories. And then we think it's kind of true. And like, oh, that person's that, this person's that. And it's just like us just being kind of a jerk.
Never really. Oh, we have this is like a little commercial in the middle of a podcast. We have a great book that we just put out of Ram Dass's stories that he's told in his talks over the years, you know, famous stories and some rare stories. So there's this one, which is exactly this. He goes to a meditation retreat, right? And he's put in a room with another man. And the other man, you're not supposed to talk anyhow, but not only doesn't talk, but never looks him in the eye. Nothing. Goes about his business. Ram Dass says, "The whole time I thought, this guy's a jerk. He's not even giving me the time of day. I don't know why. He must really hate me." So, and then the retreat ended and they could speak, and guy comes up to Ram Dass, "I am so proud that I was able to be in a room with you, Ram Dass. This meant so much to me." And he gushed out all this love and affection. And Ram Dass did what you did. Holy shit. What kind of asshole. He didn't say that quite in the book because he don't talk like that. But still, he exactly that. Boy.
Right. It's, and how we do that all the time.
All day long, walking around. Right. If it's not that, it's out of the desire systems, right? Oh, she's something, or he's something, or,
right, exactly.
Or God, what? Oh, they should go on a diet. It's a constant dialogue in your head. All right, so I think we have to do two things. One, we have to say, okay, we're human. This is Jack Kornfield, right? It's okay. We're human.
Exactly.
You know, don't be attacking yourself. You're just digging that ditch even, you know, larger and deeper. But then there is stuff to do, to work with. It is, you know, it is taking it on, as we talked about a little bit earlier, everything is, you know, food for digesting and properly or improperly. And the themes in the book, and you talk about the first one's paying attention. So yeah, let's talk about paying attention, and how important that is to really be able to have and paying attention, not from thinking mind, because that's going to end you up in the same place, judging everything, including yourself, but maybe from a place that's more open and spacious and less judgmental. And yeah, talk about that, especially in Zen tradition.
Yeah, so paying attention, you know, there's a koan collection or like a teaching collection that every teaching begins with attention, with like a big exclamation point. And for me, it's about, well, actually, I'm thinking about someone I met yesterday. And this person wanted to do one of our training programs. And she said, well, the only thing is that I'm not that interesting. And I felt such sorrow. And I just leaned forward. I'm like, how could that be possible? And she said, well, I'm just like a regular person. And I said, you know, that just makes me feel a lot of sadness. And she began to cry. And I just felt the sadness in the room. And so for me, it was a moment of paying attention and to what is actually happening. And what was happening is that she was telling the same story about herself that she probably had been saying for many, many years. And then in a moment, she actually said, I've been saying that to myself for about 20 years, that I'm not that interesting. And to me, the only time that something is not interesting is when we're not paying attention. Because if we pay attention, everything kind of pops. You know, even when we're looking at, thinking about a person that I know who was in solitary confinement, and they were talking about how the cell became super interesting because they were paying attention, and how the dust motes would kind of gather in one area and how interesting that was, and how they didn't do such a good job with the painting and were noticing like where the people got a little lazy. And, you know, just suddenly, like for this person in the cell in solitary confinement, the place became very alive and they could feel the people who had worked in the room to create this room. And the joy is actually be able to notice that, and that we're in an alive space if we just pay attention. And so that suddenly also the quality in which I am looking at you right now totally matters. And how I'm listening to you and how I'm noticing that hanging behind you and the blinds behind you, and how I'm feeling sitting here and how the space between us here, wow, that matters too. And how do I stay engaged and participate? It's just, to me, it's one of the most extraordinary things that I know. And it's a focus of practice for me to be interested. And when I'm interested, then I'm paying attention. And I remember, I'll tell you just a quick story. It's like the story that I've always loved, where this teacher who thought he was going to get the permission to teach from his teacher, from a Zen teacher, and he was going to see his teacher who he'd been studying with for 30 years, and it was raining. And so the guy came into the temple and put his shoes and his umbrella, took them off and put the umbrella down, and went to meet with his teacher, made bows to his teacher. And his teacher just smiled and looked at him and said, which side of the door did you put your umbrella? And the guy was like, I don't know. He's like, maybe 30 more years of practice.
That's great. Love that. We talked about attention, and you just said you make that really a significant part of your practice. Now, it might be good to give everybody an idea of how to approach cultivating attention through practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the things that I do in the morning is, like, right when I wake up, this actually comes from the Jewish tradition, but it's I wake up and think about 7 things that I feel grateful for. So, like, right, literally, I'm still in bed and just consider, what am I grateful for? And so there's something that happens to me when I consider those things, 7 things. I have to, like, really think, all right, what today am I grateful for? And then I start my day. Then I can go and feed the cats and then, you know, make a little coffee and then sit zazen and, you know, say goodbye to Chodo and then head out into the day. And to me, there's that kind of attention that starts for me from gratitude and really thinking about, wow, I am me because of so many things. And I'm so dependent. And actually, one of the other things, so actually I get right out of bed and I light some incense and offer it to our ancestors. And so I thank them and appreciating them. So I think there's something about gratitude and thanking that makes me allow myself to really consider, wow, like suddenly then I walk into the living room or I walk into the kitchen and everything kind of pops more. Like, wow, thank you, kitchen. Thank you. And it reminds me often of in December, Chodo, my husband, had a total knee replacement, which is like this major deal. And for 4 weeks, he was in bed and getting physical therapy. And I remember 3 weeks in, suddenly he was in the kitchen with his walker, you know, and it felt like a miracle. And suddenly I saw him in the kitchen, just standing there as I've seen him many times over the last 18 years. But I burst into tears because I realized, like, I really saw him in the kitchen. Like, there he was. And it made me realize, like, wow, there's some ways in which I put some blinders and some film on the lens of life where I'm not really appreciating what's actually happening.
That takes us back a little bit to be here now, doesn't it? It all kind of folds back in there, actually, at some point or another. Now, the other thing that we must get in here, of course, is part of what our foundation, it's part of what Neem Karoli, it's the thing that he passed on to us. What do we do? Love, serve, remember. So, and you speak of this a very, very important action that we can take. And you're talking about the service, of course. And I like how you sum it up. Your life isn't only about you. That's kind of I might be talking to myself that way a little bit. Okay, this isn't about anybody else. This is me. Okay, I'm modifying that as well, but also taking Jack's advice. Oh, we're all human, and you know we don't tend to think it's all about you, us. But the wonderful thing how you characterize this is not, okay, so service. Most people think I got to go down to the soup kitchen today, got to get my act together. But as you say, I'm pointing more to service on an ordinary level. And this, to me, I'm glad you said this, Koshin. It's really important. How do you treat your neighbor, your sister, the lady sitting next to you at the coffee shop? What would life be if you were even just a little less interested in your own stories, problems, opinions, and so on, and more interested in what's going on with the people around you? That's service. Start there, right?
Totally. You know, it was so amazing. I remember, I don't know, 10 years into what I thought I was like really into spiritual practice. And I was on a what's called session, which means the mind and heart touching itself. And I thought I was really good at the forms, really good at meditation. And I was really very self-preoccupied in how well I was doing. And, you know, as you've been pointing out, Jack is like very human, you know, like getting really into it. And then there's something that happened that shifted. I just realized, like on Zen retreats, we kind of do everything all at the same time. So you bow at the same time, you eat at the same time, you do everything at the same time. And I realized that the power of that, and the bell rang at the end of a meditation period, and I realized, wow, how much I love that, and how much I realized I was so self-preoccupied and not able to appreciate that. That how I took myself out of a relationship. And it was just like all happened within like less than a minute, that I was not really, I was still, there was that part of me that was dragging the lone wolf in everywhere, even though it might not have looked like that, but I could really feel it. And it was so extraordinary, because then I realized how the bank teller mattered, and how, you know, now I actually know pretty much the names of all the people who work in all the stores that I frequent and depend on, and the bank teller and my friend Patty, who she works in the bank, and I know about her kids and what's going on with her, and how much each of those things matter. And I was thinking about even the local coffee place, where we know everyone's name, and they're like, we love you and Chodo, because I said, well, why do you love us? And they said, well, you actually know us. And you can just see, I tell a story too in the book, but this, I think it was Carol, and who's, you know, the barista at the local place, and this person came in and was clicking on her phone, and she had done a mobile order, and why wasn't it ready? And it wasn't quite right. And she lost her shit at this barista while not even talking to her, but like looking at her phone and swiping and scrolling, yelling at this woman for getting it wrong. And then getting it back without looking at her, without saying thank you. And she left. And I said, well, how was that for you? And she's like, well, she doesn't know my life, so I don't take it personally. And the reality is, she said, she's not even in her life. And so the service and the tenderness also I learned from my friends in that coffee shop, you know, that they really understand like, wow, people are not really in their lives, and that they are available to and serving freely. You know, they have to work because most of them have kids, but the way that they serve in a free way is so moving to me. And Jason, the guy who lives outside of that coffee shop, you know, I learned so much from him. He has schizophrenia, and he often tells me, you know, all about the people who walk by and give him change or don't give him change, or who gives him a snack and who doesn't give him a snack. And he knows tons about all of them too, and about their lives. And he's like this figure, kind of like a mayor of the street. And I said, well, why is this so important to you? And he said, well, because everyone matters. And the service that he, I mean, it's so moving to me about how he models service to me. And how I always learn from him about what it means to serve. It means just to look someone in the eye. It means to say good morning.
Yeah, someone said the greatest offering that you can make another person, the greatest generosity is paying attention to them. Right? And that's what this is all about. And that's the beginning of service. You don't have to go to the soup kitchen, everybody, right away. You can do that, of course, but just start with the person that's next to you. And that's why the attention thing is so very, very powerful. Really see, and with a, you know, and trying not to judge, although we will do that too. But these practices take a lifetime. And I've been doing it
at least one.
At least one. To get, well, I'm trying to just get to that where you do pay attention and you, that generosity is naturally flowing. We're not talking about enlightenment. That is enlightenment, actually. I mean, when you really think about it. So there's a great, I know you were really, your grandmother meant a lot to you. We're getting near the end, but you got to tell this story because it's so wonderful. It's when you were taking care of her in hospice and she was actively dying, and just, you know, your relationship with her vis-a-vis you being a Buddhist monk. Tell that story and what happened through her passing.
Yeah, well, many things happened with her and with my grandma, Mimi, and really learning how to commit to someone in terms of service was one of the greatest teaching. And just to be, no matter what, that was the priority, to be together. And I never had felt so loved by anyone in my life. And yet there was always a tension between us around my Zen practice, actually. And she was, you know, comes from Holocaust survivors, and you know, as many people in that tradition face, it was just like they had a Jewish identity that was very strong, but they didn't really practice. It was not a spiritual tradition, but an identity and a heritage and a tribe. And so there was always a tension with that. And then about 2 weeks before she died, we were sleeping together in the hospice, and she woke me up and she said, you know, wake up, wake up. And I woke up and she had tears in her eyes, and she said, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And I said, what are you sorry for, Grandma? And she said, I didn't know how to love you. And she's like, in fact, in 87 years, I don't think I really even understood what it meant to truly love someone. And to love someone is to love everything about them, including the things you don't understand. And she said, and I could feel this little part of my heart that contracted away from you because of your practice, because of the Zen, she said. And she said, and I'm so ashamed about it, and I'm so grateful to release it and to love you completely.
Wow, so beautiful. Huh? Wow, that's really beautiful.
Yeah, it was one of the greatest teachings I've received.
What is the thing about ancestor? Actually, I'm just started thinking about that because you talked about it before. I've never really gotten the importance. I've heard, I've done. Actually, I have a friend, John Lockley, who's a South African shaman, and that is one of the core pieces of his tradition. And what is it to you? How is that relevant to us? I this just came to me because I actually had a, just being on Maui, had a healing session with someone who said to me that she felt my father really there for me. I'm going through this transition. It's with plenty of complexities and difficulties. And I'm like, yeah, well, wait a minute. Now I'm considering that he had good karmas. He met Neem Karoli Baba himself. But that he's probably on to his next incarnation. So what are we talking about? You know, it was a very mindy kind of interpretation of, but what's yours? What does it mean to you, the ancestor thing?
I feel like incredible gratitude for all the people that I know and don't know that brought, and that I'm alive because of all of them. And I think I didn't really understand it until understanding lineage through my Zen tradition. And there's this enormous emphasis on tradition and lineage. And, you know, on retreat, we recite all the names from who gave transmission to who for all like 91 generations from the historical Buddha to now. And so there's this great emphasis. And then I remember in my 20s reading the story about this old Zen teacher, wonderful Zen teacher named Yunmen, who at the end of his life traveled by foot hundreds of miles to offer incense at the grave of the sixth Zen ancestor. And he just wanted to do that to thank him for his life of service before he died. And this is somebody who had lived, you know, I think 200 years before him. And so for me, it's like thinking about my great grandpa Ike, who, you know, organized and housed and fed immigrants from Europe. And I think about the traditions that I think are me, and they actually, it turns out from what I hear, I'm quite like my great grandfather. And so there's this amazing non-self, like, well, maybe it's not me, but it's the amalgamation of, you know, 40,000 years, 100,000 years of DNA and heritage and tradition. And to me, it's very humbling and a way of, you know, rooting down and widening out a bit more. So ancestry, I realize, it's like, oh, like, I have no idea really what makes me me. And I'm so grateful for all those people who lived their lives so that I could live mine. It's just another way of gratitude.
Right. That's great, Koshin. Thank you.
Thank you, Raghu.
And there's one thing. How do we change our life in the book? Okay. And we've been talking about this. To me, this sums up the most important essence here that I picked up. And the answer is one, and you say is your favorite instruction from kindergarten, right? Stop, look, and listen to whatever's in front of you. Just we show up. Great word, show up. For instance, if I'm talking to somebody else, I stop, look, and listen. And then I'm really seeing the quality of a person's face, the way their shoulders are placed, how they're sitting. I'm getting curious, and now everything becomes more alive, as we talked about before. To sit with things, you say, and really let them enter. To me, this is one of the most magnificent generosities. And that's it, you know, and we just, and it's that thing around service. We just need to enact that, pay attention, enact that generosity, and that's a service. And you want to know why you're here on earth? Well, okay, start there.
Exactly.
Start there. Wonderful book, Wholehearted, from Koshin. And you, at this point, everybody go to Be Here Now Network. .com/mindrolling. You'll see the show notes page, and you'll have links to get the book and links to Koshin. And if you're in New York, I know you can get with the center and do some of the things and be part of some of the things that they do, aside from the practices, the service, and so on. And always, always a pleasure.
A joy to be with you.
Always, always. So everybody, we'll see you again next week on Mind Rolling on the Be Here Now Network.
Thank you, Raghu.
Namaste.